You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
I'm Eloisa Griggs from the Latin America Program, and I'm going to get us started and do a brief introduction of Katrine Hensing, who will be moderating and taking over shortly, and is in our Brussels office. And we also we're in New York. I'm in New York along with several others, and then we also have folks from DC. This is the first event of the Cuba series, which is co-sponsored by the Fellowship Program, the Ideas Initiative in the Fellowship Program, and the Latin America Program. Dr. Katrine Hensing, who will be moderating today's session, has extensive experience involving Cuban society in a broad range of issues, including human rights, youth, race, and gender. And she is working with the Open Society Foundations as a consultant to help us think through what the potential role and value added of the foundations might be with respect to Cuba going forward. And as part of that, she is designing this series of events, which we'll be holding over the coming months, and will be moderating today's session. And with that, Katrine, do you want to get us going?
Well, good evening and or afternoon to our audience on the other side of the Atlantic, and welcome to our first event on Cuba for this series. It's my pleasure to be the moderator of this event, which will be focusing on the Cuban economy. Now, as you probably all know, in 2006, Fidel Castro, former president of Cuba, was replaced by his brother Raul. And although that change in leadership hasn't brought any real political changes yet on the island, Raul recently undertook, or introduced rather, a sweeping set of economic, social reforms, and to a little extent also some political reforms. Now, whether these reforms will actually pull the country out of its deep, deep crisis is yet to be seen. But what is certain is that Cuba, and particularly Cuban society, is undergoing the most significant changes at the moment since the 1959 revolution. And to help us better understand the state of the Cuban economy, as well as the rationale, if you were, for the economic reforms and their impact on Cuban society, we've invited Dr. Hugo Appenhöger from the Friedrich Ebert Foundation. Uwe was the director of the Friedrich Ebert Foundation's Cuba office from 2009 to June 2013, i.e. very recently. And during this time, he worked very closely with some of the key, I would say, architects, economic architects of these reforms. He also worked closely to some of the leading actors in the government and in civil society. He is thus not only an expert on the economy, but I would say also on wider Cuban issues. What is also perhaps worth mentioning is that Uwe was the director of the Department for Central and European, Eastern European, or Eastern Europe rather, at the foundation during the 1990s. He thus brings with him a wealth of experience on transition economies and societies, which will be interesting for this discussion. He is now the foundation's director here in the Brussels office, and it is my pleasure and honor to welcome Uwe as our first speaker of this series. I'd like to jump in right away and ask Uwe to basically give us sort of a brief, maybe historical overview of the Cuban economy, as well as the state of the economy at the moment, and thus also the rationale for these economic reforms.
Yeah, thank you, Katrine, for your kind invitation. Hello to everybody. So I'll try to start with some initial remarks on the history of the Cuban economy. But at first, I would like to say that Fidel left a really difficult heritage to his brother, His legacy was in economy as well as in society very problematic when he left involuntarily in 2006 because he fell ill. He handed over a totally distorted economy to his brother. You will hardly find in our world of today a similar case of a distorted economy. Historically, Cuban economy was marked by dependencies. For centuries, Cuba was dependent on Spain, obviously, then for a couple of decades, dependent on the US and basically some multinational companies from the US. Then it was dependent on Russia after the revolution. And in our days, it is to some extent dependent on Venezuela. The dependency on Russia was partly due to the American embargo, which certainly has driven Cuba into the arms of the Soviet Union in these days. There was practically no other option for the Cubans but to look for a strong partner that would give them, who would give them some security in the continuous conflict with the US. At the peak of the dependency on Russia, Russian subsidies counted for roughly 25% of Cuban GDP. In our days, there are estimates on Venezuela that it counts for approximately 10 to 20%, and the calculations differ. A large share of GDP depends on subsidies from Venezuela. To put already this into a nutshell, it means, few people think about this, that Cuba has never earned the money it spent. It has never earned the money it spent. And especially Cuban socialism, even when it blossomed in the 80s, has not earned the money it spent. It spent the money in these days probably in a way many people liked, especially the center-left groups worldwide liked Cuban socialism in the 80s. But one should really underline that Cuba has never earned the money it spent, not in socialism, and not in Castro's, in Fidel Castro's times, and not today. Taking into account this dependency, you might imagine what shock it was when the Soviet bloc disintegrated. The disintegration of the Soviet bloc and of the Comecon was the severest or the most severe economic crisis in Cuban socialist history. 80% of foreign trade were lost overnight, 80%, and about 35% of GDP drop was to be registered in 1993. So the country fell into a so-called special period in peacetime, which was, by the way, the moment when today's Cuban economy started. Because the situation was so bad, I mean, in capitalist terms, you would say the country was totally bankrupt at this moment. It didn't matter so much because Cuba was not integrated into the world economy. Cuba, up to today, is not a member in the World Bank, not a member in the FMI. So it was totally isolated, in these days integrated into the Comecon. But in this special period, in 93, from 93 to 97 to 2000, more or less, first liberalizations took place, and there was a first move to open some parts of the economy to market mechanisms. I wouldn't call it privatization, that would be overdone, but some market mechanisms in small and medium-sized industries were allowed. But it was also the moment when the Cuban military came into the forefront because Fidel Castro in these days handed the task to Well, to solve the problems of the special period, he handed it over to his brother, by then defense minister, Raul Castro, who started bringing the Cuban military into the Cuban economy. There's one thing we should note, which might be interesting, especially for your people who know Latin America well. The Cuban armed forces have an extremely good image in society. They have never shot a bullet in the direction of their own people. They are considered the only success story institutionally. They have won two colonial wars or decolonization wars in Angola against the by then best African army of South Africa. This war was basically won by the Cuban army together with the Angolans. They were also successful in Ethiopia and in other parts of Africa. So there's a certain myth around the armed forces in the Cuban population, and the armed forces are trusted by the population, and they are considered to be the only institution which is really effective and efficient, in contrary to the party, which is not considered similar. Okay, so to summarize the situation today, I'll give you a couple of numbers, and then we look into the question why this has been the starting point for the reforms which Raul Castro has started to introduce 2006, 2007. Today, Cuba is a very small economy. I mean, I've not looked into statistics of the United States, for example, but into some German statistics. So the Cuban GDP would correspond to the GDP of a middle-sized German industrial city. I know some of you may know Cologne, which is already a big city for German standards, but Cuban GDP is not, by far not as high as the GDP of Cologne. So the Cuban economy is very small. As I have already mentioned, it's not integrated internationally, globally, not member of the World Bank, not member of the IMF, has been isolated always since the early 60s when the embargo started. The productive sector in Cuban industry only counts for 25% of GDP, which means agriculture plus manufacturing industries, approximately 25%. The other parts, three-fourths, 75%, is services. This is considered, even by Cuban economists, as a dysfunctional tertiarization of the economy. And in this economy, you always had, for political reasons, extremely high hidden unemployment. You have an official unemployment rate in our days, in 2013, I think, of 4.3%, which is already considered very high for Cuban standards, because the promise of socialism always was that there is no unemployment. But hidden unemployment is estimated at 20 to 25%. The basis of the economy in our days was created in the special period in the early 90s, when the Cubans started to build up a tourism industry. So tourism is one of the major sectors today. Then you have nickel export. Then you have a small but rather well-working biotechnology, pharmacy industry, which is even internationally somewhat competitive. And then you have health and educational services as export goods. But the main point about the Cuban economy, if you come to Cuba and look at it, is that this economy has not managed to ensure capitalization for its very basis of existence. The gross fixed assets investments in Cuba fell by 47% from 1989 to 2007. 2006, the gross asset investments were only 13.5% of GDP, which is round about half of what it was in 1989, the last year before the Soviet Union broke down. China, in some years, in some recent years, had a rate of 50% of investment, 50. Cuba has 13. And with that 13.5%, Cuba lies well below the average of Latin America also. I'm stressing this so much because this is the reason for the very fact that Cuba today is a de-industrialized country. There is no industry. There are no intact value chains. You have a total dilapidation of the infrastructure. Just to give you an example and an idea, it's not contested by the government. In Havana, about 70% of the water in the pipes doesn't reach the tap. It's just going away on the way to the tap. So they have huge infrastructure investments ahead. And then the problem is obviously that there is no capital accumulated because this kind of economy and this kind of socialism didn't allow for accumulation of capital. Cubans as citizens have low savings, so Cuba couldn't go the way of China. China has basically started its development boom on the basis of domestic savings. In Cuba, there is no capital accumulated, neither by the state nor by private Cubans as savings. One last point characterizing the recent situation is the Cuban economy is at, since 1994, working on a dual currency system. That is to say, there are two currencies in Cuba. One is the Cuban peso, which is the currency, the national domestic currency. Salaries are paid in Cuban pesos. Since 2005, 2006, about 95% of all people employed were state employees and they earned their money in Cuban pesos. In the special period, Cuba first decided for a dollarization for the export sector, and then in 2004 it was converted into a second Cuban currency, which is the convertible Cuban peso. This is the currency which is the most important currency today in Cuba. This is the currency for all the import-export sectors, because this kind of economy is also deeply in debt, and regrettably not domestic debt, but it's foreign debt. Cuba is living with a structural deficit of its trade balance and with a large foreign debt. So this foreign debt has to be paid in the hard currency, in COC, and that is one big distorting element in the Cuban economy, that they are working with two different currencies. We could go into that later if you have further questions. So to put it in a nutshell, you really have a country which is in very deep economic crisis. And this very crisis has led to an alienation between the people and the government. In Cuba, there is a term you would probably understand well. It's called resolver, which means that people have to get by. They have to resolve, find solutions for the economic problems. So the miserable performance of the economy has led to the very fact that a normal Cuban worker would earn approximately $15 a month. And together with a ration card he gets from the state, and together with meals in the canteens of the state companies, for many years Cubans still got along, but normally at the 15th or 20th of a month, the money is gone. And then people have to look how to survive. So they start activities in the informal economy, on the black market, and this has created really an ambiente of informality, and Cubans are practically not able to survive without going into these practices, which we would very often call corruption, probably. So I think for a future in society where you would opt for democratic procedures and at the same time for market mechanisms to govern economy, this will be a very difficult legacy, because people in their day-to-day life got accustomed to endemic corruption.
Maybe on that note, I'd just like to maybe add is that you know, for so long there's been this social contract between the government and the people, which basically was based on an understanding of the government supplying the population with cradle to grave, you know, basket of social benefits that included everything, you know, from housing to daycare, education, food, public transport, the works. In turn for, on the part of the population, a tacit understanding of very few, if any, civil liberties. Mm-hmm. And this social contract is now, has been for a while now, basically eroding. And it's in that space, which I think Uwe did a wonderful job in kind of having us understand, that in that space, people are looking, you know, for new ways to survive. And this is, you know, what they so aptly call resolver. Mm-hmm. And it's a phenomenon. It's a cultural phenomenon that's going over into a form of not just surviving, but, you know, corrupt behavior. And I think that's something to very much watch out for in the future, particularly as Cuba opens up more and more. Or maybe Uwe, we can now, thank you for that overview, turn a little bit to the reforms.
Mm-hmm. Let me make three more brief points, which are directly linked to what you said about the social pact.
Yeah.
I completely agree, obviously. The social pact was, so to speak, the basis, the ground stuff of the Cuban myth. Mm-hmm. Because the myth of Cuba was always that it was successful as a socialist state by providing modest to good living conditions, and at the same time continuing as a socialist state. So a lot of the projections of the outside left in Latin America, in Europe, and elsewhere, a lot of the projection was that Cuban socialism has worked. And the basis of this very impression that it had worked was this social pact you mentioned. I mean, they practically exchanged loyalty for the supply of national sovereignty, of social protection, and the abolition of poverty. Mm-hmm. And they were successful in that. So Cuba was a very egalitarian society in the 80s. Mm-hmm. I will come back to that later. Mm-hmm. Against that background, the reforms we will come to now are not a question of an option, but they are an absolute must. Yeah? Reforms in Cuba since 2005, 6, 7 are absolutely unavoidable, because the economy was totally bankrupt, and even Raúl Castro said in one of his more famous speeches in the National Assembly If we don't change, we go under. So he named it very clearly. So that I would really say that in our days, or what he has inherited, was a formerly homogeneous society in the late 80s, a rather homogeneous society, which is now fragmenting. Inequality becomes a fact in Cuban society. And this, I would call, brings into Cuban politics an element which was almost unknown, which is structural instability. Cuba was very stable politically as long as the old pact worked. But since the old pact is not working any longer, loyalty is not assured. So in our days, it looks politically stable, but it's structurally unstable because the economy is not sustainable.
Yes, and I think on that note, we'll get into this a little bit more in detail later, but it's worth mentioning now. I think that it's not just the economy and people's salaries that we're talking about. It's also the so-called achievements of the revolution, particularly the healthcare system and the education system that, you know, for so long were heralded as some of the best, with some of the best global statistics, that are now really undergoing some massive structural issues and losing in quality. And your average Cuban now basically needs to pay a bribe to get an x-ray done if he wants to have it done in the next couple of months. And so these are the kinds of things that are happening now on the ground. And this is where also the social contract is being questioned and eroding, because so many things that people took for granted for so long are now not only no longer accessible, but actually only accessible through a price in the informal sector. So maybe now we can actually turn to these reforms that are obviously coming out of a no option, really, yeah, reality. And look at in some detail what they entail. What are these reforms? Maybe you can give us some examples.
Yeah, and in the first place, I mean, it's not a voluntary political decision, but it is really an unavoidable move to save socialism, not to abolish it. That was clearly stated in the party congress in 2010. So the first thing I would want to state is that the reforms are not called reforms in Cuba, but they are called the actualization of the economic model. They are not called reforms. We call them reforms. And in this very party congress in 2010, it was stressed a couple of times that the actualization of the economic model is done not to abolish but to strengthen socialism. So what do they want to do? They want to go from 100% state economy, centrally planned, to a mixed economy, private, cooperatives, and state. This mixed economy, the vision is, if there is any clear vision, but the projection is that it should be one-third each. One-third of key industries will stay with the state, is the projection. The cooperatives, which Cuba already had in the agricultural sector, was not at all a success story. The Cuban cooperatives in the agricultural sector were a total failure. But the interesting thing now is that they are restructuring the cooperatives in the agricultural sector, and they are opening the urban economy for cooperatives. So Cuba at the moment is introducing transport cooperatives, financial cooperatives, housing cooperatives, you name it. This is apparently a smart move because it goes well together with a socialist economy, a socialist ideology, because it would be governed by market mechanisms, the cooperative sector, but it would be collective property, private property, but collective property. So there is a serious move from the Cuban side to get this cooperative sector going. They are looking to other Latin American countries, which have good experiences with that sector. Uruguay, for example, we at FES did a lot of consulting with Uruguayan experts, inviting them to Cuba and discussing with the Cubans about urban cooperatives and cooperatives in a capitalist environment. Mm-hmm. Then the most important actualization of the model lies in the sector of the small and medium-sized industries, where private property is already allowed. You can open your own company. This was also already the fact in the early 90s, in the special period. But in the special period, you could only open a company as being self-employed, and you couldn't have employees, only family members were allowed to work in your company. In our days, they opened this up, and you can have up to 50 employees in a company you may found. So the vision is a mixed economy, more or less three-thirds equally divided. That's the projection. The important thing in these reforms is that it will mean the end of the paternalistic state, which you mentioned, from the cradle to the grave, because for the first time in our days, Cubans have to start taking partly responsibility for their own economic life. That was not necessary until the late 90s. It was totally covered by subsidies, by an irrealistic employment statistic. I mentioned underemployment or hidden unemployment of 25%. So the effect will be the end or the goodbye to a paternalistic state. Mm-hmm. This is the thing which goes into the mentality and the perception of the Cubans in relation to their state. They may not have liked a lot of things the state did, but it guaranteed their survival. And this is over with the reforms being put in practice for many people. Because one of the first measures, taking into consideration the hidden unemployment, was to lay off people in the state sector. This process has advanced considerably. More than 500,000 people have left the state sector. It's obviously not called layoff, a mass layoff, but it is called restructuring of the different sectors and the companies. The projection is that until 2015, 1.3 million people will leave the state sector. This would be approximately 25% of the population economically active. You have a population economically active of 4.9 million in Cuba, and 1.3 would have to leave the state sector. So the question then obviously is, where do these people go? I mean, what do they do? Because there's no unemployment insurance, totally different notion of state care. There is no additional social policy thought of what to do with these people who will be forced out of the state sector. You know? So the basic idea was of the Cuban economists and some international economists assisting was that the bulk of the people who will leave the state sector goes into the small and medium-sized industries and goes into the self-employed sector. This is a rather successful policy. In our days, you have approximately 450,000 people registered as being self-employed, which would be roughly 10%, not yet, obviously, the 25% they're aiming at, but 10%, and this in only 2.5 years. I think it's, from an economical point of view, quite an achievement, not so much from a social point of view. So to give you a couple of ideas now, what steps are taken to make this go. In this sector of small and medium-sized industries and self-employed, market mechanisms are introduced, and this is really private property and market mechanisms. But the market doesn't work because there is no institutions and market needs to work. You don't have commercial banks. People don't pay taxes in Cuba. They don't know what individual taxes are. There were no taxes. They simply don't know what it means to pay taxes, and they don't know what to pay it for, because the state provided services anyway. Mm-hmm. So for what do you have to pay taxes immediately? Then there was no wholesale sector, which would be important for the small and medium-sized industry, because this was all a state monopoly of buying and selling these goods. No wholesale sector. Then the state starts in the agricultural sector to lease land on a long-term contract, normally state-owned land. And this is leased to people who are willing to deal with it and to work with it. At the same time, and I mentioned the end of the paternalistic state, you have to state a withdrawal of social subsidies. The ration card is getting smaller and smaller step by step. The canteen meals in factories are almost all gone. Instead of that, the Cuban workers now earn a certain amount of money, and then they have to look for where to get their lunch, which is really a cultural thing in Cuba, because since the factories were so overstuffed, meals were the basic social event every day, and very often people took something to take it home and so on. So it has more effects on the day-to-day life of people, as it may seem at first sight if an economist looks at it. The problem with the small and medium-sized industry sector, which is being created, and that's already underway for 2.5 years now, is that this is not totally liberalized. There's a list of 189 or 98 professions who are allowed to become self-employed. If you look at this list, it reminds you of a history book from the 19th century. So it's basically antique crafts which are liberated to be exercised by self-employed, but you don't have lawyers who could found their own premises, and no IT people allowed to offer their services, no teachers, no doctors, very important. So all the better qualified jobs are up to now exempt. There are some very amusing exceptions. So a couple of weeks ago, they integrated real estate brokers in the list. I mean, if you have already visited Havana once, you know why they did it. Because the western outskirts of Havana, it's a very nice area, which would immediately be privatized if the economy would be opened abrupt overnight. And the real estate brokers will certainly be people who are already well positioned, and there is quite some information around that Miramar is already sold out, more or less, and it's also known who the people are who are dealing with this. I mean, it's not so surprising for people who have accompanied the transitions in Central and Eastern Europe, where this was a very common thing, that the filet pieces were privatized in a special manner. But in Cuba, it's really difficult, and The message is, however, that this list for self-employed, which exists, would have to be opened a lot more to attract the well-qualified people, and then it would probably be more effective, and it would bring the state more tax income also, because all these new self-employed people have to pay taxes for their employees and for their company.
So maybe one thing to maybe just add here, Uwe, is that because of what he just explained, we have this very almost ironic situation where a waiter in a hotel or a manicurist or a hairdresser, one of the professions that has been legalized, earns a lot more. And we're talking, 20, maybe even 50 times more than a doctor or a lawyer or another professional who still only earns in pesos cubanos, the national state salary. And so you have something that's called the inverted pyramid that has been created. And as a result, on the popular level, a lot of resentment. So now it's very, very difficult to find a lot of professionals leaving their professional jobs. Doctors, teachers, IT specialists, etc., desperately trying to get a job as a gardener in the hotel or as a waiter in the tourist sector. Not because they earn better salaries, but they earn tips in hard currency, with which they can then make a much better living. And so these are some of the anomalies, as it were, that have and are continuously arising in this reality. And that actually, unless you want to add to
just one thing.
Yeah.
I wanted to add. I think it's very important to note that this inverted social pyramid has catastrophic political consequences, because it means that your status in society and your income is no longer determined by work. No longer determined by work. Our societies, more or less all of our societies, are based on work as the principal income source. Work at education, but work is bringing salary. Yeah? But in Cuba, for young people, for example, it's no longer so attractive to go to school and learn, because later on they don't have a perspective to get a decent job. So what they do is they go for easy money in this hard currency sector. Yeah? And you really have this situation that work is no longer conditioning your social status. But the way you resolve your money problem is conditioning it. Yeah? And no society survives that for a long time if you have a leading heart specialist in a clinic in Havana earning five times less of a waiter in a restaurant where tourists pay in hard currency. So it's really a very severe political and social.
Yeah, it's a time bomb ticking, really, isn't it? So that actually leads me to my next question, which is if you, now we've sort of understood, I think, now that, so that the economy is now being diversified. And in so doing, there are all these different elements arising. And so I wanted to ask you whether, so now after a few years of the reforms taking place, if one can already actually visually observe some of the, let's say, impacts, economic and social, on society of these reforms. I mean, can you actually now, going to Havana, see what's happening on the grassroots level?
Yeah, I would say you certainly see it. What you see in the first place, and this is very visible, is that you have growing social inequality. And again, I give you a couple of numbers. In the good times of Cuban socialism in the late 80s, the Gini coefficient was, the Gini index was 0.24. I suppose you're familiar with Gini. So in 89, it was 0.24, which was quite equal even distribution of wealth and income.
Mm-hmm.
In 1990, it was supposed to be 0.38, and nowadays it's supposed to be 50. That would be as bad as in Brazil, which is one of the countries which most with the highest income differences in the world. So this for Cuba is a total disaster, because the promise of socialism was equality, basically, by providing the services we have mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
So if you come into Havana now, I mean, you can see it in Havana all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, on the one hand, you see different cars, modern cars, rich people's cars. You see iPhones and iPads and young people with that stuff, where you ask yourself, where do they have the money from? Either from their parents or from remittances from family members abroad or from the black market. And then you see it in advertisements. Havana is a really interesting place if you want to go back in history 60 or 80 years. There are practically no advertisements, not at all. I mean, it's in the night, it's a beautiful city because you're not harassed by advertisements, light advertisements all over the place. So you see it in the cars, you see it in the stores that open, you see it in the streets, many people are selling stuff. Yeah? Now the problem to me looks like many of these self-employed have gone into what is easiest to go into, which is restaurants and trade. They are trading different things. But what they trade is normally not produced in Cuba, but it is imported privately or semi-privately or by corrupt means of getting around the customs. Yeah? So it's very little stuff which is traded, which is really produced in Cuba. So that I would say that it might be an illusion to think that this new self-employed sector is anything stable. There will be a moment when this market will have to clean up also, because all these services which are provided have to find purchasing power to be practiced.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as the Cuban state doesn't ensure decent salaries for the workers, which is closely linked to the end of the dual currency system and to more productivity in the companies, in the big companies, as long as the salaries will not go up, this sector can't grow. It only can grow up to a certain extent. Yeah? The other thing which you note is that somehow you see that inequality is not only a question of access to the hard currency, but inequality also becomes a race question, class and race. So you notice that Afro-Cubans are worse off, white Cubans are better off. This is due to a very simple fact. When the revolution took place in 59, who left the country was the bourgeoisie. They were practically all white, approximately 300,000 in the first 2 years after the revolution. All the rich families, the bourgeois families, practically 95-100% white, left the country. These are the people who now are sending remittances to Cuba in hard currency. So people who have access to the remittances are much better off than people who don't have any access to remittances or access to the tourist sector or the sector where you can earn the hard currency. So I would certainly say that it is not only inequality of race and class, but it has come to a point where today it is inequality in access to opportunity. Because the Afro-Cubans don't have the same access to opportunities, be it education or economic, as white Cubans.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's another probably explosive point to watch in terms of race and class overlapping. So it seems to me that what you're saying is that there are some real winners and losers,
mm-hmm.
or has and have nots
mm-hmm.
emerging.
Mm-hmm.
And Afro-Cubans, many, not all, but many or maybe most of them, fall into that group of
yeah.
have-nots. Who else would you kind of, if you could kind of come up with a list of the winners and the losers,
yeah.
who are visibly now part of the nouveau riche Cubans and who are not?
Yeah, I mean, the division between winners and losers we know also from Central and Eastern Europe, because for many people there it was not clear in the first place who would be winner, who would be loser, and it was also not clear that there would be more losers than winners. In Cuba, both terms are new. Yeah, I mean, they have not been part of the debate in the in university or in politics. There were no winners and losers because the official doctrine was equality. So who are the winners and the losers? Apart from the race question we have mentioned already, the losers are old people, pensioners, who can't live any longer from their pension. An average pension in Cuba is approximately $10 a month. With the indications I gave you before, it's totally impossible to survive on $10, even with ration card. So then it is groups we also know in other countries. It's families without a father, alone educating mothers, pensioners. It certainly is all the people who have only a basic education. Yeah? And the winners on the other side would be clearly people of the former bourgeoisie, which has left the country. Normally, they have left some people in Cuba also. So that part of the real estate market in Miramar is done between these families. So some of the people are living in not only in Miami, but in Madrid, in Mexico, in Santo Domingo, in Pittsburgh, in New York, in Mexico. Yeah? And these people send money for other family members who are entitled to legally buy property, real estate property. So that this division of certain neighborhoods is legal, but it's functioning on the basis of a mechanism like this. So then I would say artists, sports stars are benefiting from it largely. In general, people who are entitled to leave the country easily. I don't know, you probably have accompanied that Cuba has liberalized migration laws approximately a year ago. That was one of the major reforms on the social side of the medal. It's now perfectly possible for every Cuban who is not working in a strategic sector, this is defined by the party, what is a strategic sector, but if you're not working in a strategic sector, you can apply for a passport and then you can travel. The trouble is that most of the people don't have the money to pay for the passport, nor do they have the money to travel. So they cannot even ask for a passport. They can try to collect money to get a passport, and then they still cannot travel. But the people who are already in these in the Coke economy, our currency economy, for them it has made traveling a lot easier. They can go where they want. So you do have, I would say, a group of people, if you want to call it nouveau riche or a new middle class, which is benefiting from the reforms. I would like to call your attention again to the military as being part of this group, because in today's Cuban economy, there are calculations that 60% of GDP are maneuvered or managed by people who come from the military or are ex-military people. You shouldn't think about people in uniform, obviously, but the Cuban military is somehow a state in the state. They have their own hospitals, they have their own universities, so it is an extremely well-educated group of people, very loyal to Raúl Castro, who was 48 years the defense minister, the longest serving defense minister in the world, 48 years until he took over, and he has stuffed the key positions in the economy, basically with people he knows from military. So they are also behind the reforms in the military, and they are benefited by the new.
I'd just like to come back one more time to these vulnerable groups that you've talked about, the elderly and particularly Afro-Cubans, who, by the way, make up probably about 60% of the Cuban population, Afro-Cubans. So this is not a minority we're talking about, it's actually the majority of the population. So what do you think, Uwe, are some of the steps that the government could take to support these vulnerable groups? Because as I hear you mentioning, there's so far no social policy really in place to help or protect them. But what do you think could be done, should be done to support these groups that are obviously are becoming more and more vulnerable?
I think it's really a big challenge, especially because the government continues to pretend that Cuba is a socialist state and a state caring for its people. Castro has mentioned in a couple of other speeches, or in a whole lot of speeches, that nobody will be left alone. This has obviously to do with the legitimacy of the regime. So when I was still in Cuba discussing with the economists, I challenged them a couple of times and told them that they were only looking for getting the economy going, and they were not looking on the social side of the impacts of the reforms. And regrettably, I have to say that Cuban economists who are designing the reform are not caring so much about it. You have a number of sociologists who are investigating for a long time already the social situation in Cuba, and you can clearly note that this is one of the major construction sites for the regime. I mean, what one would have to do is, apart from designing support mechanisms like an unemployment insurance or some basic standards in subsidies for people who drop out of work and out of the subsidies of work. But there is very little done up to now. And I think this will turn into an important question for the regime and its legitimacy. Because if you imagine in a situation like the one Cuba is in, you suddenly have an unemployment of 15 or 20%. I don't really know how they will want to manage this. They are not well prepared for that. And it is objectively difficult. I mean, we know that from debates about development policy, poor states, which by definition don't collect sufficient taxes to put in practice sustainable social policies, do have a problem at this point. So I think an additional aspect for Cuban reform policy would be precisely the design of accompanying social strategies to deal with the dropouts.
So I wanted to maybe just actually, you know, bring this to our last question, which is, I mean, from what Uwe has told us, you know, the shape of the Cuban economy and this desperate need for both, you know, local or domestic production and foreign investment, which we haven't talked too much about, but obviously the country needs, leads me to this question of, you know, what do you think would help to dynamize the economy and open up the economy in such a way that more employment could be created, and there would be more money for, you know, for social programs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this is objectively difficult because, as I said, there is no private saving. The state doesn't have the money. Even if he wants to, he cannot collect all too much money from its people. So FDI, foreign direct investment, will be a crucial factor in a development strategy. But what I would like to stress at this point is that all the reforms up to now look much more like a trial and error kind of thing, and not like a master plan with a certain more or less concrete objective, let's say in 2020 or 2025.
Mm-hmm.
And what is really important to stress is that the major objective in all the reform has been that it is an orderly transition. Transition and reform under the control of the party. And the control element has always been stronger than the motivation to liberalize and create space for activity or for private enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
So control is the major motive behind the reforms. To some extent, the Cubans are looking to China and to Vietnam, because this would be the reference models where you have a one-party state with a party still in power and a rather well-going economy with all the problems. The Cubans know how corrupt China is. They know how foreign direct investment in Vietnam went wrong because it went into tourism and the financial sector. So Cubans are aware of this. So what I would want to stress is that the Cuban leadership doesn't have a master plan. Control is the principal, control of the process is the principal motivation. And being so, one can say that Cuba is really looking for its own way. It's not trying to copy. It's not trying to copy China. It's not trying to copy Vietnam, not to talk about the Eastern European countries. This would be worth a debate on its own. Cuba has a very negative image, the Cuban economists do it, of the transition in Central and Eastern Europe and how it went. It's not at all a blueprint for Cuba. So I think what they will have to do is truly create space for the private economy they have started to open. This would mean implant a working banking system, start collecting taxes, then they could do something to reallocate resources. They collect taxes and then they do some balancing via distribution of the money. And then FDI is a crucial point. But the trouble with FDI is that since the Cuban economy is so small, they have no negotiation power, hardly any leverage if they negotiate with a big multinational company. Because a big multinational company will have profits or turnovers which are bigger than Cuban GDP. So if they would go for a smart strategy in foreign direct investment, they should go, and they partly go, for middle-sized companies abroad. But this is also difficult because of the American embargo, because the embargo still punishes not only American companies, but also other companies who have business in the United States. They couldn't go into some more direct link with Cuba without being punished by the American government. So the last point is FDI will be crucial. It will be crucial how they design FDI as a strategy. And in this respect, Cuba is really trying, after the experience with dependencies, which I mentioned in the very beginning, to diversify its trade and development partners. Since they were forced into dependency, they now try to diversify, which means it's still Venezuela, but the European Union is the largest trading partner. Then you have Canada as a very important partner in economic policy. Brazil. Brazil is building the biggest harbor in Mariel, which can be a very important cornerstone. So I would say diversification is really the way to go, and that's what they do. Back to Russia, back to Ukraine, with China, with South Africa, with the BRICS, and then it might work.
Well, thank you, Uwe. I have many more questions, but let's hand over to our colleagues in the different offices. Thank you so much.
Yes, hello. Thank you for such an informative presentation. I have a couple of questions. One regarding the relaxation of migration laws. We have seen that this has given an opportunity to some very important activists to tour several countries, the US, Europe, etc. Yoani Sanchez, the Damas de Blanca, etc. Do you see this as a sign of political openness? I mean, the government knew that these activists were going to take the opportunity to advocate internationally. And my second question has to do with the relationship between Venezuela and Cuba. Since the death of Hugo Chavez, Venezuela has been facing, you know, very difficult economic an economic crisis, and many are saying that eventually this will impact the support provided to Cuba. I just wanted to hear your opinion on that. Thank you.
My name is Angelica from the Latin American program. Thank you for your presentation. I would like to hear your opinion about the impact on the named progressive governments in Latin America of these changes in Cuba and a possible more and a possible transition in Cuba.
And I'm Kathy Ross, also with the Latin America program. This has been a great discussion so far, and I'll be interested to hear the wide, the range of questions. My question is, given the panorama that you've laid out about the kind of the range and level of direness of the economic difficulties that Cuba faces, and the what Katrine laid out in terms of where the social pact is, that there has been this, that the basis of the relationship between state and society has been shifting and changing. But if economic liberalization takes place immediately and suddenly, it would provoke a wave of privatizations that would exacerbate many of the difficulties that we see now. So you've laid out these issues. My question is, what is the level of discussion of these kinds of issues within Cuba, and where is it happening? I assume that there's one level of discussion within government circles that is quite tightly controlled. Are there discussions elsewhere in academic settings, also perhaps kind of tightly controlled, or is this whole thing kind of an elephant in the room on the island without any recognition?
Well, I may as well start with the first question: migration law, political openness. It was stated clearly by the government that there will be economic actualization of the model, and there will be no political reforms, explicitly stated by the Cuban czar of the transition, Minister Marino Murillo. The very fact that they changed the migration law was the carrot the government offered to the people, because it put pressure. It was like letting pressure out of the pot, because people were waiting for something that affected themselves directly. So the opposition people who visited, who left Cuba and like Yoani Sanchez toured more or less the world, we should have clear that the so-called opposition in Cuba, regressively, is a very small group. Yoani Sanchez is not belonging to the traditional opposition, as it is called, but she's new kind of opposition in the new social media. But the opposition, which was partly also supported by the United States, is a very small group, and that's a group that's divided. I mean, rather vulgar, what is the saying in Havana is one third is authentic, one third is paid by the Americans, and one third is from the Cuban Secret Service. That is what how people look at it. Again, I would say this doesn't apply to Yoani Sanchez, which is a different generation and a different approach to a fight for democracy in Cuba. So I would say political openness indirectly through the space of maneuver people get in the economy, but not as an attempt from the side of the government to create more debate. On the contrary, there is a strategy of harassment of opposition people, which is more stressy and more violent in our days than it was way back. Venezuela and Cuba. Indeed, I mean, Venezuela depending on Cuba, Cuba depending on Venezuela, as I've mentioned. If Maduro would not have become president, it would have been a disaster for the Cubans, because another Venezuelan government would probably have reduced the subsidies and eventually abolished it. So I think there was heavy Cuban involvement in the whole election campaign. And the trouble is that the Cubans know that Maduro is a very weak candidate. He cannot in any way compete or be a successful successor of Chavez, because, well, generally speaking, I think that was said by a famous Latin American author, Caudillos don't have successors, and that's the case in Venezuela, and with Chavez also. Okay, next question: progressive governments. The progressive governments in Latin America, I suppose you're talking about Uruguay, about Brazil, about the ALBA states, Bolivia, Ecuador, and so on. They obviously are favoring Cuban reforms because they want to reintegrate Cuba into regional structures. That's probably a thing you know better than I do. There are different attempts to reintegrate Cuba. As for ALBA, I think it's more a tiger on paper, because ALBA is a lot more political discourse than real integration. Institutionally, it's not working at all, and it was living on the basis of the petrodollars paid by Chavez for his political interests and Cuban political interests. What I think is interesting is that governments like the Uruguayan one, Frente Amplio, and also the Cuban government are very positive towards Cuba and Cuban reforms. And from my opinion, they are investing a lot into support for the Cuban transition process. Okay, last thing, social pact. Level of discussion, and I think you should also
maybe I just say a few words on that. Thanks for that. It's a really good question. You know, I think that it's really important to understand how people are dealing with the reality now vis-a-vis where they're coming from, and that is the special period, the 1990s, where basically there was no food, there was no electricity, there's no medicine. And so Cubans generally always compare the now with the then.
Mm-hmm.
And so in comparison to the 1990s, the current situation, which is much more complicated and complex and confusing, is at least for most Cubans still better than the 1990s. Because now you might have to resolver, but you can resolver. You can probably find something that you need on the black market. Before, you know, there was the black market was tiny because there was so little, you know, just circulating in the economy. So I would say now most people are making sense of all of these economic and social reforms, and their reaction is a bit sort of schizophrenic almost, because there's some excitement that they finally can legally travel. They can finally legally buy and sell property. But of course, most people can't do any of this. But the fact that they can have the right to is exciting for them. And then comes kind of sort of the shock of their reality, which is that many people are being laid off. Many young people, this is affecting young people in particular, are not getting jobs. And they are then also becoming increasingly frustrated. And so on the street level, you hear a lot of frustration. People are complaining because they thought that what they were going to get was going to be a little bit different. So there's a general sort of discussion, and it's laden with complaints, a lot of jokes, because Cubans, you know, have a way of dealing with frustration, which is telling jokes. And then beyond that, you also have just people trying to survive. And so, you know, the resolver, this struggle for survival, actually is so time-consuming, so that a lot of people don't actually have time to even think about what's going on. And I think that's also, I personally think this is, you know, a strategy of the state to, keep people busy, to not think that much. Mm. Where there is some discussions, more say beyond the just level of frustration, the street discussion happening is in, I think, three major spaces. One, academic, among scholars, independent scholars and intellectuals. You have a couple of writers, filmmakers, also. And then also in the cultural sphere, a lot of artists now, through their art, through their production, kind of commenting on what's going on. And then probably most interestingly is the religious or church sector, particularly in the Catholic Church. There are two important journals, Palabra Nueva and Espacio Laical, that you can actually see online. I highly recommend particularly the latter, Espacio Laical. It is the most serious and interesting independent journal, lay-run, and very well read on the island and in the diaspora, way beyond members of the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. And what's said in Espacio Laical is then commented, you know, beyond the parish sphere, as it were.
It's also as far as you can go.
Exactly. I mean, Espacio Laical kind of shows how far you can go within the Cuban state. Maybe one more set of questions, maybe?
So, thank you again. One of the questions I have is about, pertains to the Cuban diaspora population, particularly, I guess, the U.S., you know, Spain, the U.K., and what role do you see that population playing in this reform, and particularly what foreign, what FDI and what infusing capital, and to what extent does their involvement relate to the political shifts or lack thereof?
I will add a quick question on in the diversification efforts in terms of economic relationships. Ask a little bit more about Brazil and whether that is something that is your expectation would grow that relationship, and how it's being perceived internally or valued, or what sort of questions there may be about that relationship.
Anybody else?
I think that's it from here.
Okay.
So we start with the diaspora. I think a very important question, because we have not commented too much on it. In my opinion, the diaspora can play a decisive role, an important role, in the Cuban reforms. I think the diaspora has changed. I suggest that Catherine comments on it. She knows the situation in the diaspora better than I do. But from an economic point of view, we have examples of other countries where money from the diaspora helped develop a certain country. So this, in my opinion, could also happen in Cuba. My impression is that the diaspora, or many people in the diaspora, are willing to do that, but the Cuban state has then to secure their investment and has to build trust. This is difficult because the people in the diaspora were up to now called traitors of Cuban socialism. So So it would be a change, yeah, in the image, in the official image of people in the diaspora from the side of the Cuban regime. I think eventually the Castro people will come to that because they need the money. It would probably be the easiest money to get. And you probably in the diaspora have a lot of Cuban patriots who are willing to support a sustainable development path of their country, putting aside the ideological differences they had for a long time. So I think important role for the diaspora.
Yeah, just to give you a figure, I mean, these are conservative figures, but at the moment, about $1 billion enters Cuba through remittances every year. That's a lot of money. And it's coming, you know, from Miami and from other parts of the diaspora, basically into Cuban households. As you can imagine, the level of development that could happen on the island if it were to be legalized to open up hometown associations and the like. So there's a lot of thinking and interesting questions to be asked around that. But at the moment, it's all this money is being sent from the diaspora into Cuban households on a very individual level and really helping Cubans either survive and or now open up their small businesses. Again, there's this interesting and very worrying aspect of race involved that is unfortunately, you know, creating new inequalities that are race-based with this migration and remittance question. I think what's interesting to think about, though, is that as Cuba's changing, reforming, opening up more, so is the diaspora, in particular Miami, and this has to do with just a basic biological issue, which is that a new generation or new generations are coming up on both sides of the Florida Straits, and younger Cubans are less angry, less embittered than their grandparents or even parents were or are, and that's where I think some exciting developments are happening. There are more and more young Cubans, particularly in Miami and in the U.S., interested in reaching out to their counterparts on the island and doing so, curious, you know, to look at Cuba for what it is today and not just the Cuba their grandparents tell them about. So I think that's actually something to watch, observe, and at some point maybe assist.
Yeah, somehow I would say the diaspora already is kind of a private credit line for Cubans. Since there are no commercial banks on the island, the credit lines is the diaspora, the only reliable credit line. Brazil. Brazil, the image of Brazil under Lula and his successor is very positive in Cuba. And I would say, in the intellectual circles, in government, in university, people are keen on straightening links with Brazil. Brazil, at the same time, is not so easy for a communist government because Lula's victory, or the two election victories and Dilma's victory in succession, symbolize for many people in Latin America that some kind of socialism, however you may term it, is also possible under capitalist conditions and in market economies. We shouldn't forget that for many decades, Cuba was the only successful left-wing experiment on the continent. Then came Nicaragua, which was self-destroyed in a short time. But the success of the social programs of Lula's and Dilma's governments are known in Cuba. And I'm personally convinced that many of the economists we work with, for example, they have a certain admiration for the Cuban development path under this center-left government. So that I would say from the Cuban side, there is a strong will to straighten links with Brazil. And from the Brazilian side, there is a rather strong disposition to really support Cuba, this is not only a political question, it's also an economic question. Brazil has turned into the hegemonic power on the continent, in South America, and Brazilian businesses looking for opportunities, and Cuba is offering good conditions. So it's as well political as economic, as an economic question. I think it will go on for quite some time.
I had a question. This is Vonda Brown from the Latin America program. I was curious to know, with the different ways of resolviendo the situation in the families, what are the, let's say, maybe criminal elements or informal elements? How are those operating in Cuba? I was curious to know, and how does the government deal with those?
I mean, for me, it's difficult to say. In the first place, Cuba, in comparison to other Latin American countries, as you know, is a safe place. And the closest cooperation with U.S.-American institutions is with the Pentagon and with the Coast Guard, and in protecting drugs coming through Cuba or around Cuba to the U.S. So you do have rising criminality, I would say, without having statistics. But at the same time, this is one of the elements the regime will instrumentalize in its argument that capitalism is bringing bad influences. In Havana, it's busy. It's no longer as secure as it was 3 years ago, not to talk about 10 years ago. So I don't really know how they will handle it. From what we know from Cuban authorities and security forces, they are only used to force and not to sophisticated prevention strategies or stuff like that. Drugs are an issue, but not at all an issue of the size as in the other Caribbean islands.
Yeah, I would just say, you know, this is one thing that more or less still, particularly if you compare it to Cuba's neighbors in the region, is still something that somewhat is under control, i.e. public safety. But this is because of the fact that Cuba's a police state. I mean, you know, I mean, it works. You know, people let their children play in the street because they know that nothing's going to happen, because if something would happen, the police would be there within seconds. On every block in Cuba, there's something called El Comité de la Defensa de la Revolución. And they work basically as neighborhood watches. This is something that still works. But if that were to be taken off, as it were, that police state protection, then things would probably get very complicated very quickly, I would think. Because the level of frustration, the level of just basic survival mechanisms, also the level of anger people have towards the authorities, towards their neighbors who might have told on them, you know, to the state, etc., is quite high. And in terms of drugs, you know, drugs are available in Cuba, but they cost a lot, and most people don't have the money to consume them. Young kids, which there are many of who are highly frustrated, if they go into that direction, they usually take some kind of pharmaceutical drugs or alcohol, which is quite cheap. You know, very, very high proof rum. Alcoholic proof rum, which is very, very cheap in Cuba, are the main substances of abuse. And this could quite quickly, I would think, go into other substances if people had access and the money to consume them. So I think it's just a matter of time that those issues become problems. And because of Cuba's geopolitical location, those could become very, 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 very big problems in the future.
Well, just one final comment from my side, which is linked to that. I think there is one last consensus in Cuba between the government, the regime, and the people. And this is they don't, all of them don't want to go back to a pre-59 situation, yeah? Which would quickly be the case if you take the lid from the pot at once. Yeah? Because it's in the way of the main drug corridors. Yeah? In international crime is so globalized today. If Cuba would open from night to day, it could really end up in a disaster, eh? And it would turn again into a neighborhood of Miami, so to speak. And this is, from what I have felt in discussions with different Cubans, is one of the last consensus you have in Cuba. And one additional last comment, which is, it might be that Cuba is lucky coming so late with its transition, because it, now the Cubans can look at the other transitions we have accompanied, the transitions in Central and Eastern Europe, the transition in Vietnam, the transition in China, somehow the transition in Chile, in Uruguay, in Brazil. So if Cubans were smart, they could probably benefit from all these transition experiences. The Poles, the Hungarians, the Czechs couldn't in 1990. There was no reference. The Cubans do have different references to design their development path. And if they do it smartly, they have another big advantage. And that is Cuba is economically not important at all to anybody, which makes them not a playboy in a geopolitical game. They could really design probably their path to sustainable development in a better condition than a country that would have raw materials and commodities, where foreign influence would be a lot harsher.
Well, I think we have to, unfortunately, end on that note. Thank you, Uwe. Thank you in DC and London and New York for participating. Look forward to seeing you again.